Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Is it possible to eat your way into good mental health? Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman, and I am your co-host today, along with Clarissa Kennedy. Today, we speak once again with Dr. Georgia Eady about whether it is possible to change your mind by changing your diet. Dr. Georgia Eady is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who specializes in using nutrition to improve mental health. She received her medical degree from the University of Vermont and completed her residency at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Eady is an internationally recognized expert in nutritional and metabolic psychiatry. Her 25 years of clinical experience include 12 years at Smith College and Harvard University Health Services, where she was the first to offer students nutritionally based approaches as an alternative to psychiatric medication. Dr. Eady co-authored the first inpatient study of the ketogenic diet for treatment-resistant mental illness, developed the first medically accredited course in ketogenic diets for mental health practitioners, and was honored to be named a recipient of the Baszucki Brain Research Fund's first annual Metabolic Mind Award. Her new book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, was released on January 30th, 2024. So welcome, Georgia.
Thank you very much, Vera and Clarissa, for having me. It's great to be here.
So please tell us again how you first became interested in nutritional psychiatry, which is a radical shift from traditional psychiatry.
Yes. So I practiced traditional psychiatry for the first 10 years of my career. And then through my own health struggles, which eventually led me to some experimentation with my own diet, I stumbled into the realization that the brain cares very much about what we eat. And it had not been anything that had ever crossed my mind, honestly, up until that point. So it was my own experimentation. And then that led me to years of independent study of nutrition and trying to understand what the truth was about nutrition science and what the brain and body actually need to be healthy and function at their best, which is, of course, very different from what we've been, the information that we've been fed for so many decades. Then I gradually started incorporating into my practice, and it's with wonderful results. Some of these dietary tools are the most powerful interventions I have available to me as a psychiatrist.
Can you give just a thumbnail description of what nutritional psychiatry actually means?
Clinicians and researchers and scientists who consider themselves nutritional psychiatrists, and I consider myself a nutritional psychiatrist, we believe that a large reason for why we have so many mental health problems in the world is due to the deterioration in the quality of the diet. And so we believe that there are many dietary root causes of mental health conditions. We don't all agree on what the best solution is to that problem, but that's the field of nutritional psychiatry is founded on that belief, that diet largely responsible, not entirely, but for a lot of the increase in mental health conditions that we see. Then there's also metabolic psychiatry. So consider myself a metabolic psychiatrist. And metabolic psychiatrists believe that a lot of mental health problems are rooted in problems with brain metabolism or brain energy production. So I consider myself both a nutritional psychiatrist, meaning dietary quality matters, and metabolic psychiatrist, which means how the brain makes energy.
And they can't be seen as the same thing? I would have classified them as the same thing, but you're making a distinction.
I'm only making a distinction because that's how the fields right now are defining themselves.
Yeah.
I like to see them as intricately connected, which is I wrote the book to bring them together, actually.
All right. Oh, perfect. That's exactly what we're going to be talking about. Before we get to that, though, when did you realize that sugar specifically or processed foods were a problem for the brain, especially since that there's been no diagnosis along that line? So what was it that twigged you? Was it that personal experience that you alluded to?
I have my own very long history of addictive eating and overweight and all kinds of other food issues going back to childhood. So I always knew. I always just instinctively knew that food was negatively impacting my own mental health and my own physical health. But I didn't ever study that relationship until probably until 2007 or 2008 was when I first started looking at these things closely. And the field of nutritional psychiatry, again, we believe that the diet is at least largely to blame for a lot of the increase in mental health problems. I wanted to understand, what was it about the diet? What was it about our modern unhealthy? What makes our typical diet so unhealthy? What ingredients specifically are driving, for example, addictive eating behavior? When it comes to that question, it seems to me very clear that while there may be questions about other ingredients, I'm convinced that refined carbohydrates are the most addictive element of the modern ultra-processed foods diet. But then there are other ingredients in the diet that are directly damaging brain health as well, beyond addictive properties, meaning that they can cause inflammation and oxidative stress, which is why we're always told to eat more antioxidants, right? We have too much oxidative stress. And insulin resistance that interferes with the brain's ability to reliably produce energy in a very stable way. So those three things, I think, are really intricately connected to the ultra-processed foods in our diet, the refined carbohydrates, the vegetable oils, and all of the ultra-processed foods.
Before we actually get into the book, was it easy to get a publisher for this book? Are publishers ready to hear this?
What an interesting question. Was it hard? Yes and no. So it was easy. I had a wonderful agent, and he, of course, really helped me identify publishers who might be interested. There was a lot of interest in the book, and I did have a lot of interviews with publishers. That was the easy part. The hard part was when these interested publishers would go to their managing editors or their supervisors or their bosses and say, this is what we want to do. And it was fascinating to me how many of them did not feel comfortable with some of the arguments in the book, supporting, for example, the importance of animal foods in the diet. And in some cases, we got letters that were very specific about this, that this was a difficult position for them to be in. And that was surprising and disappointing. But fortunately, there were still publishers who were willing to take a chance on the book, despite the fact that some of the messages are politically challenging right now. And so we did have some competition for the book contract, and I'm very happy that we did eventually find a publisher that was willing to take a chance on it.
Awesome. I'm wondering if I can ask you specifically, like diving into your book, about why you think maybe some of the rates of anxiety and ADHD and depression are rising so rapidly right now.
I think there are a few different, I think, very strong possibilities there. And one is that if we're looking specifically at diet, diet is not the only reason, of course. There are lots of environmental influences that can be contributing. And these include things like toxins in the environment, pollution in the environment. These include things like our computerized culture. We're not spending enough time outside. We're sedentary. We're isolated. We're staring at screens all day. We're not in the sun. We're not exercising enough. Those things are really important for good brain health and circadian rhythm, stress management, sleep schedules, all of those things. So not to discount, those are all very important. But the things that I focus on, my area of interest is nutrition, and the deterioration in the quality of our diet really over the past 50, 75 years, it's just appalling. We have gradually been replacing real whole foods, whole plant and animal foods, like peaches and fish and eggs and nuts and fruits and vegetables, with ultra-processed extracts and ingredients and powders and liquids and crystals extracted from those foods and mixed together in these intentionally addictive combinations, which are then, I imagine, somehow subsidized by government. I don't know why they're so cheap. It's fascinating to me how inexpensive they are. And they're just everywhere. And so we are, most of what Americans are eating right now, more than 60% of what we eat right now isn't food anymore. It's ultra-processed ingredients that don't behave like food in the body or in the brain. So these ingredients are literally damaging the brain from the inside out, damaging its delicate architecture, making it more and more difficult over the years for the brain to produce energy. And energy is everything to the brain. The brain is a very high energy organ. And if it doesn't get enough energy, any number of things can and will go wrong. But then on top of that, we get inflammation and oxidative stress and all kinds of that directly cause neurotransmitter imbalances, these imbalances in chemicals, that these are the very same imbalances that the medications that I was taught to prescribe are designed to try to correct. We never really stop to think, well, what's causing those imbalances in the first place?
Can you be more specific about, for example, ADHD and maybe anxiety?
Absolutely. So let's break it down. For example, we'll start with ADHD. There are some neurotransmitter imbalances that some people think are driving ADHD. These are dopamine and norepinephrine. And you can see that when you eat the wrong way, if you're eating a lot of refined carbohydrates, for example, that are causing glucose spikes in the brain, the unstable glucose levels in the brain, that can destabilize some of the pathways in the brain that regulate dopamine activity. And then the other connection there is that when you're eating addictive refined carbohydrates and you're actually some of the studies tell us in the addiction world that you are unnaturally spiking your dopamine levels and can eventually wear that system down and it can become numb. And you can feel like you need to be overstimulated in order to function. So I think there's some dopamine dysregulation that can occur by virtue of the fact that we're overstimulating that system with ingredients that aren't food. And so that's another piece of the ADHD puzzle. But then the energy piece is also. So for example, in order to be able to concentrate and remember, those are two very important pieces of ADHD. It's not that people with ADHD can't pay attention. It's that people with ADHD can't direct their attention where it needs to go when it needs to go there. And so I have lots and lots of patients with ADHD who champions at paying attention to certain things. But in order to function and aim that attention where it needs to go, when it needs to be there, is really difficult. It's executive function problems. And so if the brain doesn't have enough energy, it can't reliably focus and remember what it needs to pay attention to and keep track and prioritize all those higher level brain functions. Those are very high level brain functions that require really high quality energy, smooth, reliable energy throughout the day. ADHD has a lot in common in terms of some of the symptoms with very early kind of mild cognitive impairment that you see in pre-Alzheimer's, where it's just hard to...
Wow, that's what a statement that is.
You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to get your act together and organize your day and remember where you need to be and pay attention and remember the little things that you need to take care of. And I'm not saying that they're the same condition at all. But what I'm saying is that some of the symptoms are similar. And what you can see in both conditions is that if you improve the delivery of energy to the brain, you can see improvements in those symptoms sometimes in just a few days. I think that's really important.
Am I pushing you to say that we think about children with ADHD, and of course we think about the way children are being fed sugar now. Would it be too far to say that the way that we feed our children right now is the cause for the spike in ADHD that we're seeing today? Or is that going too far?
I can't prove that, but I absolutely do believe that is a large part of it because, and I know this partly because I don't work with children. I work with college students for many years, and I work with adults with ADHD because, of course, adults can have ADHD. ADHD runs in my own family. And I used to work at an ADHD specialty clinic for a couple of years, and I worked with college students for many years. So I have a lot of experience with this condition. And I also studied the relationship between nutrition and ADHD a number of years ago. And there are some beautiful studies, all conducted in Europe, it's got to be at least 30 years ago now that they were conducted, where they took children with quite severe ADHD. Some of these cases were so severe that the children were hospitalized for hyperactivity symptoms of ADHD and oppositional symptoms and those sorts of things. And they gave them they fed them what was called a few foods diet, which was a very simplified diet. It had maybe 8 or 9 foods in it. They took out all the common allergy culprits like chocolate and dairy and nuts and eggs. And it was mostly whole foods. So it was things like poultry and vegetables and fruits, that sort of a diet. And the only processed foods that were in the diet were, in a lot of these cases, it was things like white rice and apple juice and margarine were the kind of the worst foods in the diet. The rest of them were all whole plant and animal foods. And within weeks, most of these children, 2/3 to 3/4, depending on which study we're talking about, responded beautifully to these diets. And many of them didn't meet criteria for ADHD within 3 or 4 weeks. It's just fascinating to me. And the diet must be a major player in cases like that.
Yeah. So I'm curious, just because you said you have so much experience with ADHD, I'm a clinician that works with clients with food addiction, and we always see the anxiety starts to go down, depression symptoms start to go down, but not always is the ADHD completely addressed if they might be unmedicated and they may not require medication from what I think you're saying. Is there a particular dietary intervention that you would use or recommend for clients with ADHD? Is it more ketogenic based? Because we hear a lot about that. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so there's no formal research yet of ketogenic diets for ADHD, and there's no formal research that I'm aware of any kind of dietary intervention for adults with ADHD, right? So I can't say from a research perspective that, you know, that I can't hang my hat on that. What I can do is in my practice, as most mental health conditions, most mental health diagnoses come with attention problems. So a lot of people who have depression, who have anxiety, who have psychotic symptoms, who have bipolar disorder, PTSD, lots of different types of mental health conditions include disturbances of attention. And a lot of those people will even meet full criteria for ADHD as their secondary diagnosis, right? And because just about anything that disrupts normal brain function is going to disrupt attention. And so it's really common set of symptoms that we see. And I use a lot of dietary interventions in my practice, and the ones that I use most commonly are the three that are laid out in the book. And so one of them, the way I will usually start, unless somebody wants to jump right onto a ketogenic diet, is I start by cleaning up the diet with, I love to start with a paleo diet if people are willing to go there, as opposed to the Mediterranean. I like to go a little bit further and use a paleo as a starting point, because it does remove a lot of the more common culprits that can cause inflammation and just aren't very nutritious and can be irritating to the system, the immune system and the gut and so forth. I like to start there, but with a lower carbohydrate load, not ketogenic level, but just a more kind of reasonable amount of carbohydrate from whole foods in the diet. So some fruit and starch at each meal, fine. Not.
What do you define as low? Like 60 grams, 80 grams of carbs?
So in the book, what I recommend in the book as a starting place for people is 90 grams of carbohydrate a day. So there's 25, 30 per meal, something like that. So that's the standard diet includes 300 or more grams of carbohydrate per day. So this is about 2/3 less than that. And I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah, it sounds like a way to ease in rather than starting with something that might feel too restrictive for too many people. And I noticed in your book, you talked a lot about some key micronutrients. Can you share a little bit more about the micronutrients you think are really important?
Yeah, so they're all important, but I think what you're getting at, which and I think is really important for us to talk about, is that there are some nutrients that are much harder for us to get from standard diets than others. And unless you know where to find those nutrients, you may be running low on them. And so a really great example of this, a really common example of this is iron. And iron is required to make dopamine, for example. And so you'll often see iron deficiency is more common in people with ADHD and even in children with ADHD, and zinc as well. So iron and zinc deficiencies, as well as omega-3 fatty acid deficiencies, are more common in kids with ADHD. Gee, I wonder where we might get more of those. We're told that the best sources, the best foods, whole food sources of those very important micronutrients are the animal foods. And it's just very clear when you look at it logically and objectively, that's where they are. It might look as though they exist in other plant foods in abundance, but one of the key messages of the book is just because a plant food contains a nutrient does not necessarily mean you can access it easily, because plants guard those nutrients and with anti-nutrients. And sometimes the nutrients are the iron that's in plants is in a form that's much harder for us to use. For example, the omega-3 fatty acids that we need do not exist in plants at all. They only exist in animal foods and in supplements that are extracted from algae. So algae is not a plant. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was to help people understand some of the kind of surprising truths about nutrition that's so different from what we're used to hearing. Now, if you have an attention problem, you want to make sure that your brain has all of the ingredients it needs to be able to make those neurotransmitters, for the cells to be able to be flexible enough to pass those neurotransmitters back and forth, and for the receptors to be functioning, to have all the amino acids they need to be able to receive those neurotransmitters and process them, and that you have all the minerals that you need for the nerve cells to fire when it attaches to those neurotransmitters. It's not just about dopamine. It's about the whole system that dopamine can't work by itself. An iron deficiency, as I'm sure you both know, as women in as health professionals and females, that we just think it's normal for 20% of women to be iron deficient. Oh, it's just, yeah, we were just, that's the way it's supposed to be. That makes sense, of course, because women have menstrual cycles and of course they're going to be running. No, my goodness. What creature would be designed to be deficient in an essential nutrient? It just makes no sense. And what I like to say about iron is that if you have iron deficiency, which again, at least 20% of women do, at least of childbearing years, reproductive years, whatever you want to call it, you don't just have a blood problem, you have a brain problem, because the brain needs iron to create certain neurotransmitters like dopamine, and the brain needs iron, the mitochondria that generate energy inside the brain, they need iron too. Iron sits inside the electron transport chain and it's critical for making energy. And so all kinds of things can go wrong if you're running low on any nutrient, but iron is one I think that's worth calling attention to because most people don't think about it as a brain mineral.
What about vitamin D? That's another one that I see almost everybody has a deficiency in.
Exactly. So vitamin D. So why are we also deficient in vitamin D? So one issue is that we're not spending enough time in the sun because we make vitamin D in response to sun exposure. Even in the wintertime, a lot of us can't get enough from the sun because the angle of the sun is too low. So where I live in Massachusetts, it's hard to get vitamin D in the wintertime. So I do take a vitamin D3 supplement with vitamin K2 in the wintertime. But something interesting I learned when I was studying vitamin D deficiency was that when you replace vitamin D, like lots of people are low, but when you replace it, it doesn't always seem to help very much. And one of the things I came across in my research for the book was that insulin resistance to play an important role in how well vitamin D is converted into its active form and how well the vitamin D receptor functions. So that, because these often go hand in hand, vitamin D deficiency and insulin resistance are really closely linked. And so they used to think, a lot of people used to think, and maybe some still do, that vitamin D deficiency caused insulin resistance because they were so often seen together, kind of guilt by association. But the newer research suggests that what's happening is actually the insulin resistance is interfering with vitamin D's ability to function. And that makes a lot of sense to me because there are some studies now show that if you correct the insulin resistance, then the vitamin D replacement works better. And so I think that's a really fascinating line of research.
What's another micronutrient that seems to be really important?
Yeah, so another really important one are the omega-3 fatty acids, DHA and EPA. So these are long-chain omega-3 fatty acids. They're not designed to be burned for energy. Most fats we burn for energy or we use them to build things. But these particular, and we can make fat ourselves. We can make fat out of protein. We can make fat out of carbohydrate. We can make all of our own fat. You can eat a fat-free diet and weigh 300 pounds because every extra molecule of carbohydrate that you eat that you don't need in that moment is going to be turned immediately into saturated fat. And so you don't have to eat any fat to make fat. But there are some fats we can't make. And so these are the essential omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. And the omega-3s are the famous ones, DHA and EPA. The brain requires a hefty amount of DHA in order to function properly, particularly, it's especially critical during the first 1,000 days of life, during pregnancy and through age 2. That's when the brain is actively, rapidly developing and requires lots and lots of DHA. And it can only come from animal foods or algae-based supplements, which haven't existed for very long. There's a common misconception about omega-3 fatty acids that you can get them from things like flax seeds and chia seeds and walnuts, that there are plant omega-3s. And there are, but they're the wrong kind. So they're a kind that is almost impossible for us to convert enough of into these other molecules that we need. So in most cases, and especially during pregnancy and early life, you cannot meet the developing baby's requirement for DHA through plant ALA supplements and foods alone.
And so the only way to get that is by eating salmon and like fish or fatty fish and that sort of thing.
Yes. fatty animal foods, especially pasture-raised and wild seafood and wild fatty seafoods and pasture-raised, the fat of pasture-raised animals, because the omega-3 fatty acids come from algae, which fish eat, and grass, which cows eat. Now, we can't eat the grass or the algae directly to get the omega-3s. We have to eat the creatures that are able to extract the omega-3s from those green things.
So I'm wondering, because I know we have some vegetarian listeners out there, and I know probably you also have come into them in your own practice. How do we talk to vegetarian clients, or how do you work with vegetarians around giving them this information and then making some suggestions that might benefit their mental health?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, because I am nutritionally pro-choice. So I really want everybody to have a seat at the Better Brain Health table. And I want people to feel comfortable about the diet they're eating, and I respect people's choices. So what I want them to have is the information they need to make the best possible choices, the brain healthiest choices within their preferred dietary pattern. So I work with lots of people who eat vegetarian, vegan diets, and I would like to say, and I mentioned this in the book, there is a world of difference between a vegetarian diet and a vegan diet. You can construct a beautifully healthy vegetarian diet, because the vegetarian diet does include animal foods. And those molecules from things like eggs, they're almost irreplaceable. You know, you really do need a certain amount of animal food in the diet to be optimally healthy. And vegetarians, especially vegetarians who are willing and able to tolerate eggs, they don't need to worry. It's people who choose a vegan diet where there's significant risk involved, and it's just much more difficult to make that diet as nutritious and safe as it could be. It requires an awful lot of knowledge and planning and a lot of careful supplementation. It still, in my view, is not going to be as good as including animal foods in the diet would be, but people can make their choices based on what's most important to them. So I think if they have the right information, they can make these really simple and important changes to a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet that we all should be making to our diets, whether we're eating animal foods or not, like no refined carbohydrates, no vegetable oils, don't eat grain. There's really no earthly reason to include grain in your diet. It's really doing nothing for you. And it's just all risk and no benefit, essentially, unless you have no other choice. And these are pieces of information I think that most people just aren't accustomed to hearing. And I think people who are following a vegetarian or vegan diet, who care about not just the health of animals and the planet, but also care about their own health, I think this information, I hope, will be useful to them, because I would hope we all want to be healthy. And there are lots of things you can do within your dietary pattern of choice to make it healthier, even without adding animal foods to it.
So if you're following a vegan diet, not only does it affect your physical health, but it affects your mental health. You may be predisposed to more anxiety, depression, ADHD.
Exactly. A healthy diet is definitely not just about like weight and cholesterol levels and heart disease and things like that. It is very much a determining your brain's ability to function, to develop in early life, to function throughout your life, and to stay healthy and robust for the rest of your life as you age. Healthy brain aging. The brain cares a lot about what you eat. Yes, mental health is at pandemic levels of mental health issues right now around the world.
This actually goes to the interplay between the metabolic health and mental health. You're saying there's epidemic for mental health. There's epidemic for metabolic health too, diabetes and insulin resistance.
Exactly. So that's, you set that up so beautifully, because that's one of the themes in the book, is that our metabolic health, meaning our blood sugar and insulin levels and whether or not we're at a healthy weight, those kinds of things. There are lots of clues to poor metabolic health. And these include not just having extra belly fat. That's one of the clues. But also high triglyceride levels on your cholesterol panel, high blood sugar after you eat a starchy or sweet meal, and having high insulin levels, which nobody tests, but which they should. So there are certain clues to insulin resistance that you can easily measure yourself at home. It's often called prediabetes, and prediabetes because over the years, it can eventually turn into type 2 diabetes unless you make some changes in your life. Similar to the iron statement, I like to say, if you have a blood sugar problem, you don't just have a blood sugar problem isn't just about diabetes anymore. It's also about mental health. Because if your blood sugar and insulin levels are running too high too often, And what drives them up to unhealthy heights is primarily the refined carbohydrates. If you're eating too many of the wrong carbohydrates too often and you're getting these spikes and these crashes in your insulin and glucose levels throughout the day and into the night, that's very destabilizing for brain chemistry as well. And over time, it will damage the brain's ability. It will damage the ability of insulin, not glucose. Glucose will still waltz in, no questions asked, to be burned for energy. Glucose, blood sugar will still get in. It's the insulin that's going to have a harder and harder time getting in. The brain becomes insulin resistant. And the brain can't use glucose properly and turn it into energy properly and to full capacity without access to adequate insulin.
That's what happens.
Exactly. So what happens is so you've got this brain that can be swimming in a sea of glucose and still be slowly starving to death due to this growing insulin deficiency. And that's what really paves the path to all kinds of mental health problems, but most importantly, or perhaps most dramatically, Alzheimer's disease, which is a disease in which gradually kills the brain. And so in order to keep that brain energized safely and reliably for the rest of your life, you want to make sure that you're feeding it properly and keeping those insulin levels in a healthy range. And that's really about primarily, especially if you're younger and healthier, eating whole foods and avoiding all of the processed foods. And if you're older and have some insulin resistance, or even if you're younger, because now young people have it too sometimes now, paying attention to those glucose and insulin levels and making sure you're eating in a way that keeps your glucose and insulin levels in a healthy range.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening. Hey, Food Junkies listeners, we are so excited to announce that Dr. Amy Reichelt is joining our Sweet Sobriety team as our principal nutritionist. In order to celebrate this collaboration, we are offering our first nutrition course in April called Enhancing Cognition Through Nutrition, exploring the impact of food on cognition, emotions, and development. Amy has created an incredibly unique course that will teach you how our food choices actually influence our behaviors and how we think. We already know that food is an addictive substance. In this course, Amy is going to take a deep dive with you into how food actually changes our brain beyond the reward system. Dr. Amy Reichelt has a PhD in neuroscience, a Bachelor of Science with honors in psychology, and an advanced diploma in nutrition. She is a certified health and nutrition practitioner who has authored over 60 peer-reviewed scientific articles on food addiction, cognition, brain development, the gut microbiome, and behavior control. In this workshop, you will get 3 live psychoeducation sessions. The first one is called The Brain-Food Connection, Cognition and Nutrition. The second one is Feeding the Mood, all about food and emotional well-being. And the third one is Nurturing Young Minds, Nutrition and Brain Development, where she will discuss interventions and strategies to reverse the negative effects of poor nutrition on our brain development. We will have one last 1-hour session where Amy will answer any and all of your questions regarding this course and material. These courses will be held Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, starting April 10th. And going April 10th, 17th, 24th. May 1st will be the live Q&A for all participants. Cost is $50. Can't wait to see you there. Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
Now, a family doctor listening to you might say, okay, I can see the value of having a good metabolic profile, but come on, Alzheimer's, depression, anxiety, you can't really change that. Do you have any clinical experience to actually show that you were able to show either a halting or even a regression of some of those conditions?
Absolutely. Do I see it in everyone? Certainly not. Do I see really remarkable improvements in most patients? Yes. Do I see full recoveries in some patients, even some patients with serious mental illnesses? Yes. And in addition to my own clinical practice, because people listening might think she could say whatever she wants, how do we know this is really happening? So I do share some stories in the book, including some publicly with people's names, and so that they've been gracious to share their stories. But I also helped publish a study in 2022, the work of my friend and colleague in Toulouse, France, Dr. Albert Denat, psychiatrist practicing in France for 35 years, now actually more. And he invited 31 of his most treatment-resistant patients with severe chronic mental illnesses. We're talking schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression, who had been in treatment for an average of 10 years, some as long as 30 years.
Treatment-resistant. Medications just didn't help.
They were on an average of 5 psychiatric medications at the time they decided to come in and volunteer for his study. And these were patients who had minimal response to years and years of psychotherapy and medications and repeated hospitalizations. They came into the hospital. He gave them a whole foods, mildly ketogenic diet, so low carbohydrate diet, whole foods. And within 3 weeks, 3 of them were not able to stay on the diet long enough to be followed. But those who stayed on the diet for 2 weeks or more, every single one of them improved, and not just a little bit. We're talking 6 to 10 times the degree of response to the diet compared to medications, antidepressant and antipsychotic medications. 43% of them achieved full clinical remission from their primary psychiatric diagnosis.
Even schizophrenia. And you know what's really insane is that the medications that we give schizophrenics and treatment-resistant depression, anxiety, are usually antipsychotics or things that make metabolic health more dysregulated.
Thank you so much for mentioning that, because this is a really important problem that my patients face every day. For when I've been practicing for 25 years, and the antipsychotic medications, which can be really very important pieces of treatment for people, especially people in dire straits. It can keep people out of the hospital. It can keep people safe from self-injury. It can hold families together, keep people in school. These medicines, when they work, they don't work for most people, but when they work 25-30% of the time, they can be really life-changing. But at what cost? So the people who do get relief from these medicines pay not just a price in terms of co-pays here in the United States, but also they pay a price in terms of their metabolic health, because these medicines raise insulin and glucose levels within minutes to hours of the average dose. They triple their risk of type 2 diabetes. They shorten their lives by 10 years on average. We're talking cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, heart. It's just to have to make that decision between your mental health and your physical health is a decision that a lot of my patients are struggling with every day.
Psychiatrists must know this, like the traditional psychiatrists, because they often will prescribe a diabetic medication in anticipation for this. But how can they go to bed at night and sleep comfortably? How can they justify this?
I practiced that way for 10 years, and I honestly didn't know there was a better way. And I think that's what it is. I think most psychiatrists don't know that there are alternatives, that there are really powerful nutrition interventions, not just medication interventions, which I'm glad that we have. Medications that can help reduce insulin resistance and help people reduce their appetite and keep their glucose and insulin levels lower. But why are the glucose and insulin levels high in the first place? It's the huge amount of refined carbohydrate coming into the bloodstream. And if you turn that spigot off, the glucose levels come down and the insulin levels come down. No medications required, right? So if you look at the root cause of those soaring glucose and insulin levels, it's a really powerful intervention. Now, I understand most patients may not want to do this, and a lot of doctors may not have the time or the interest in learning how to do this with patients. I do teach clinicians how to do this, but I think that in most cases, psychiatrists just aren't aware yet of interventions. Yeah.
Now, I have a patient who's got Parkinson's. Is there enough evidence or your clinical experience to say that even Parkinson's can be halted if he gets off the refined food, because he admits he's a sugar addict?
Yes. So I haven't looked closely at the Parkinson's research for a number of years. I looked back at it a few years ago in preparation for a presentation, I was giving a conference in Switzerland. I did review the science, and there was a lot of science to support the notion that some of the very same processes that are happening in the background in Alzheimer's disease in terms of energy deficits and proteins misfolding and accumulating and gumming up the brain are happening in Parkinson's just as they're happening in Alzheimer's disease. And I do know that there is some scientific evidence to support the possibility that a ketogenic diet could be useful in Parkinson's. But I also, the little bit that I know about the non-dietary causes of Parkinson's, I also know that there can be some toxins involved in that process as well. So it's certainly not all about diet, but what I learned about Parkinson's several years ago in preparation for that presentation was, as a psychiatrist, I don't treat Parkinson's, but boy, it was eye-opening to see how many similarities there were between Alzheimer's, which I've studied very intensely, and Parkinson's. There were so many parallels.
I'm wondering if we can switch a bit and talk about food addiction for a minute. I know that you are a part of our consensus workshops for the ICD, and I'm hopeful you can speak a little bit about how do you see food addiction being framed? Do you believe in it? And do you think that it requires a diagnostic label? And what would you call it?
Oh my goodness. So yes, I am very proud to be part of that initiative. And I really wish I could be at the conference in London in May, which is going to be amazing. So if anybody out there is listening, please attend if you can. It's going to be wonderful. Do I believe in it? I absolutely do believe in it. And my own personal experience, my years of clinical experience, and my reading of the research. So those three pillars underneath me in terms of supporting that belief. So it's not just a belief. It's a belief that has some support. So there's that. And then do I think it's important to have it as a diagnosis? I do. And largely because until it's in print in some sort of official manual, it's not going to officially exist in the minds of clinicians. And even in the minds of everyday people who are struggling with this, who are blaming themselves for these behaviors that really make no sense. It can't simply be a matter of willpower. We all know these foods aren't good for us, and yet we can't stop eating them. And it turns out it's not our fault. It turns out that the foods are designed to do this. And one of the things I say in the book is these foods are designed to make you hungrier and to make it feel as though you can't get enough. And those things are signs of an unhealthy relationship. Food should satisfy you. It should nourish you. You should walk away feeling full and energized. You shouldn't walk away feeling empty and wanting more, hopeless and helpless around it, and feeling just absolutely terrible about yourself. All of the same hallmarks of any other addiction. Yeah. There just is no difference in the behaviors and in the feelings that come along with it, the remorse and this kind of self-blame that go along with these behaviors. So yes, I think it's important for it to be validated as a scientific and clinical construct. And then the other thing you asked was, if I had to pick something, I would think it would be refined carbohydrate addiction. And the reason I say that is because there are other things that essentially are sugar. And a lot of people don't realize that. I know you both realize that. Flour, fruit juice, white rice, these are all just sugar molecules. And they're just different. It doesn't have to be sweet to be sugar. And they're all just as addictive. So I put a little quote in my book from a woman I worked with who was struggling with food addiction. And she said, I don't have problems with sugar. I said, but rice? I could do a face plant in a bowl of rice. Some people are sugar people. Some people are starch people. I'm a starch person. My mom is a starch person. You could lock me in a room full of candy bars. I'd be fine. But starch, different story. So it's interesting how we're all a little different. But I would call it refined carbohydrate addiction because I think what's happening there is that these naked carbohydrates, they turn instantly into glucose in the bloodstream, and this tsunami of glucose, it's normal for glucose to spike. I hear critics saying, oh, but it's normal. Yes, of course, but not to that degree. And so you've got this unnaturally steep spike in glucose, and then you get this unnaturally steep spike in insulin, and then you're off to the races with these peaks and valleys for hours afterward that are throwing up all of your hormones, including your appetite hormones and your stress hormones and your reproductive hormones and your blood pressure regulating hormones and on. Your whole system has become destabilized from within, and you're hungry again in 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah. So you're really tying again the metabolic link with the addiction link. I want to ask you a question. This is a hypothesis that I'm working on. Tell me if this sounds reasonable to you. Could you make the argument that food addiction might be, instead of its own entity, or maybe it still is, that it is yet another manifestation of metabolic disease, like Alzheimer's, like diabetes?
Okay. I need to think deeply about that. And the reason why is I'm thinking about the direction that the arrows are going. Are they going in both directions or just?
Yeah, right. They're definitely related because you've just said it yourself.
Absolutely related. Putting it apart too much in my brain. I haven't thought about this before. Could food addiction be a manifestation of metabolic syndrome? Well, they definitely go hand in hand in a lot of people. So the question is, the metabolic syndrome causing people to overeat and be drawn more to these, I guess you could say that.
Because it's an insulin spike in the sugar. Anyway, I'm working on this one. So it sounds like it's a reasonable hypothesis.
No. Oh my gosh, you certainly could. I don't see why you couldn't say that, right? Because what's driving this, what's making you hungry for that hit, that sort of glucose hit and that dopamine hit, are these foods themselves, and is that pattern itself, that metabolic pattern? That's fascinating to think about it that way.
Can I ask you about Ozempic? What's your impression about Ozempic in this context of metabolic syndrome? It's supposed to help metabolic syndrome, and it's supposed to dampen the addictiveness itself, and it makes you not want to eat. So what's your impression about that in the context of this interplay about nutritional and metabolic disease?
There's so many things to say, but maybe the easiest way to respond to that would be to tell a story about a patient. So a patient I worked with for 4 years or so now, decades-long history of food addiction, and has successfully beaten other types of addiction, including severe alcohol addiction. So a very strong person, a very wise and insightful person, who has struggled now for years, even though it's been sober for a very long time from alcohol, still struggles with food addiction and still struggles with obesity and has a lot of metabolic issues like type 2 diabetes and heart disease and things like that. We worked very closely together trying to improve the diet, and he's done an amazing job improving his diet, but still overeats the foods that are on the diet plan, right? Because that behavior is so ingrained from a really significant trauma history and on top of everything else. So after a couple of years of this, he was really struggling to keep his sugars in a healthy range for overeating the right foods, right? So for the most part. And yes, it was hard for him to stick to the diet because of these addictive foods, but even when he did stick to it, would overeat. I eventually said to him, you're really struggling. Maybe you want to talk to your doctor about medicine in the Ozempic family to support everything you and I are trying to do, all the good work you're doing around your food. And so he went and talked to somebody, and I think it was Wegovy that he was prescribed as in that family. And these are injectable medications once a week, and they tend to make people sick. So we'd get the injections, and he was getting sick for a couple of days after each injection. So he didn't like that. But then once the sickness wore off for the other 5 days of the week, it was interesting to observe what happened for him. Because yes, his appetite did go down quite noticeably, which for him was a relief, right?
Yeah.
But what happened was because the food addiction brain kicked in and said, I'm not overeating anymore. I'm eating half a plate of food and I'm stopping. I wonder if I could eat whatever I want. I wonder if I could eat all the foods I haven't been letting myself eat in a controlled fashion.
You said it. This is the food addict brain, isn't it? This is a great story.
Right? And he observed, he's a very intelligent, he's really observed, he's, wait a minute, this seems a little dangerous. But he indulged as an experiment. Oh, let's see what I can get away with. Maybe I can keep my weight in a healthy range, appetite's under control. This is great. So all the refined carbohydrates came right back into the picture. And so that was going on for a number of months. The weight started to creep up. The glucose levels, blood sugar levels started to creep up. And he was starting to feel less in control of his health. And the thing that really bothered him, this is a guy that I have a lot of respect for, the thing that really got his attention was, wait a minute, the whole reason I worked so hard to go on this low carbohydrate diet in the first place was to get off insulin injections, which I successfully did. And now I'm on another injection? What am I doing? And so I think he was able then after a few months to say, this is not what I want. I want to be healthy. I want to be healthy. And so he came off the Wegovy. And we are now working together again. We've made some different changes to his diet. He's actually experimenting with a carnivore diet now, which is working better for him than a sort of standard low carbohydrate diet. We've still got some room to go, some work to do. That experience of his taught me so much about the pros and cons of these medications. Again, I'm a pro-choice person. If you want to use medications to treat these conditions, okay, but that's not really going to solve our global mental health or metabolic health crisis, right? We're going to give children these injections? How much money are we going to spend on this? What's causing us to want to overeat like that in the first place? That let's start there.
Yeah, that carnivore diet, he wasn't going to overeat on his state, like not really.
He still can, but it's not as detrimental to his health. Yeah.
Because we're getting close to the end, I want to ask you, where do you see the field of metabolic and nutritional psychiatry going, or where would you like to see it go?
To the moon. I really do think that this is the future, so the cutting edge of psychiatric care. And I really do, because the research is exploding in this field. We've got some beautiful studies that have just been published and some more coming out. We've got some wonderful people in the field, scientists, clinicians, grassroots, patient-led efforts, and philanthropists working on this and investing their time and energy and resources in educating and treating and inspiring people about these interventions. This is the first time. It's a pretty exciting time to be a psychiatrist. Our field has really been standing still for decades and nothing happened.
The medication's working only to a point, and that's it. And at the same place but since the 80s or 90s.
Just a standstill. And the medicines fail most people. And then the medicines have their place, and I still use them, but they really fail most people. So we need hope, and we've got it.
And your book is fabulous in explaining that hope.
Thank you. I hope that the book brings hope. I want people to know that dietary changes can help them in ways no medicine can, sometimes in a matter of weeks, but you have to know which dietary changes are the right ones to make, and they're not the ones that we're used to hearing about.
Your book gives those, plus it's very readable. So folks, read this book because it's very readable.
Thank you very much for saying that, Dr. Charman. And I also recommend that you pair it with Food Junkies. I couldn't include a lot of information about, I did the best I could to include some information about food addiction in the book because I think it's important. But of course, I didn't write a whole book about it. So please digest that information as well. Put those together.
Yeah, I have to agree. Your book was just so easy to read. It was perfectly laid out. And it's so like step by step, I think, for anyone could pick it up and make big changes in their life, which is so accessible, which it hasn't always been for a lot of people when it comes to mental health help.
Glycer, that is music to my ears, because I honestly did worry. I struggled a lot with how to aim it. So I wanted a lot of science, but I also wanted to be helpful to everyday people. So thank you for saying that. So maybe it's not as challenging as I was worried it was going to be.
No, so far it's the book of the year.
I agree. So what is next for you, Georgia?
Let's see. I'm running a training tonight in about an hour. What's next for me? That really is the big question. One of the blessings of the book has been there have been some new opportunities and ideas that have come my way. And I'm trying to decide like how I want to best spend my time. I love teaching. I love teaching clinicians, but I also love teaching the public, like just answering questions and helping and get information in the hands of people that need it. So I want to do more of that. But in terms of what my next kind of focused project is going to be, it's more than likely going to end up being either some kind of education or research project, but to be determined.
Okay. So stay tuned is what you're saying.
Yes.
And then we have already asked you our signature question. So I thought I would ask you a different question. And it is, in writing this book, what was your biggest takeaway from the research or some kind of nugget of information where you were like, wow, this is important and people need to know this?
It's funny because I did do a lot of extra research for the book beyond all the research I've been doing for years and years. And so the cutting edge where we don't still know a lot, but I'm terrified to learn more, is about vegetable oils. I think it's just fascinating. I can't wait to see what scientists discover. I've included what I thought was worth including in the book, and hopefully it gives people pause about these supposedly healthy plant-based oils that we're supposed to be replacing all of our animal fats with. But I really am concerned about the level of vegetable oil, and it's virtually impossible to avoid it. It's every restaurant, every packaged food, every hot bar, just everything, baked goods, because we're supposed to not use animal fats anymore in our baked goods. So it's just a little terrifying. And I think there's enough information there to be concerned. And the other thing is that even if we don't have all the I's dotted and the T's crossed yet on the science of how these vegetable oils impact our health, the good news is that there's no earthly reason to consume them in the first place. They're completely unnecessary. They do nothing for you, and they probably are doing quite a bit against you. And so that is something that I didn't know a lot about before I started researching for the book.
That's great and so helpful, and especially when it comes to inflammation, right? Specifically what we're learning.
Stress. Yes.
Yeah.
People listening, we've only touched the surface of the content of what this book gives. nutritional psychiatry, metabolic psychiatry. I really believe it's the future. So it's a must-read book, and it's a really pleasant book to read. Thank you so much, Georgia.
I'm very honored to be here. Thank you so much for all your time and for all your kind words, and I hope everybody has a wonderful day.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.